from bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Ah, there you are. Welcome to Monday's programme. What a miserable, rotten day it's been in Salford. Easy for me to say. It is July 27th, 2020, Monday's programme. Welcome to a brand new week. Hope your weekend was good.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, the Irish journalist and writer of great talent. Journalist and writer. You know, it's a Monday. Maybe I'll go back to bed, get out and start again. The terrific Irish journalist and author, John Waters, returns to this programme and he'll be with me in about a half an hour's time. Extended conversation. You don't want to miss that. One of the things we'll be talking about is an article in today's Irish Times by the Professor of Constitutional Law, Sarah Fulham McQuillan. The headline is Strong Legal Basis for Making COVID-19 Vaccinations Mandatory. It's a very interesting piece in the Irish Times. I'll talk about it in a few minutes' time. John Waters to take on that. Mask wearing, civil liberties, and much more a little bit later on this hour. Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? I'm in grand fettle, fine fettle, good form. And yet you find yourself every Monday, something invariably goes wrong. I know. So how have you been? How was your Monday? Do get in touch on Twitter and let me know. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. You know that. So I look forward to hearing from you. Torrential rain for July. It's been absolutely horrendous. But there you are. Gardeners probably delighted. That's the cliche. Let's start off with a bit of crack. Why not? A bit of crack. Did you hear this today? I think you might have heard it. And if we're connected on Twitter, you and me, you would have seen an article that I linked to. Did you hear this today for a bit of crack?
80,000 tourists are being moved out of the Vietnamese city of Da Nang after three of the city's residents tested positive for COVID-19 over the weekend.
Yeah, I know. I had to double check. Then I had to triple check. Then I had to pinch myself. What was that again? 80,000 tourists evacuated? Why?
80,000 tourists are being moved out of the Vietnamese city of Da Nang after three of the city's residents tested positive for COVID-19 over the weekend.
For three positive tests. Kinel is going on. 80,000 tourists. Scenes like this were playing out on Vietnamese beaches yesterday. What the hell is he doing is right. Get out! So 80,000. And apparently they're airlifting them out of Da Nang. Planes taking off and landing as we speak. Here's the rest of the report.
Vietnam had gone 99 days without community transmission of the virus.
It nearly made 100.
The authorities there hoping the evacuation will, as a consequence, contain the outbreak. Sky's Asia correspondent Tom Cheshire has the latest.
Come on, Tom.
There seems to be, for a region that was first to be hit by coronavirus, got it under control largely. It seems like it's coming back. And in Vietnam, this is an extraordinary operation. As you say, only three COVID-19 cases, but they are trying to get 80,000 people out of that. It means 100 flights a day for the next 4 days. I'm not sure we've seen that sort of approach to a lockdown before. Da Nang is a tourist city. These are local tourists. The borders are shut.
Yeah. Wow. I just couldn't believe what I was reading. But that's the way forward anyway. That sort of hysteria. That's taken you'd better be safe than sorry to the extreme, eh? Isn't it? Primary school teachers now and head teachers will be looking at that every time they take the kiddies to the local swimming baths, eh? Why not, you know? Mrs. O'Shea, the kids are ready, but I don't know if they should go in the pool. Little Ali saw a daddy long legs in the bathroom. You know what I mean? You know?
Out of the water!
Get out! Madness that. Three cases. 80,000 people being evacuated. I don't know what to say about that, so I won't say anything. That's head feckery. That is head feckery on, well, levels that I never thought possible. Now, back to what I mentioned a minute ago, Sarah Fullan McQuillan. There's a mouthful for you. She's Assistant Professor of Constitutional Law at UCD. Writing in today's Irish Times, the headline, Strong Legal Basis for Making COVID-19 Vaccinations Mandatory. So I'm going to read you the article, and I'm skipping through a few paragraphs, but I'm not changing things around, right? So I'm reading it in sequence, but I'm skipping on a bit. Promising results from COVID-19 vaccine trials emerged last week, writes this woman. While concern grows about the non-attendance by close contacts of coronavirus patients for testing. If a viable COVID-19 vaccine is found, will the Oireachtas legislate for mandatory vaccination? Mandatory vaccination programmes exist in other European countries, but not in Ireland. Rather than constitutional law being a barrier to this type of legislation, it might in fact support it. Skipping on. Personal rights protected by the Constitution include the right to bodily integrity, privacy, autonomy, health, dignity, life, and the right of the person. Protection of the family unit has given effect to parental rights to make healthcare decisions on behalf of their children. All of these rights are directly relevant to any legislation providing for mandatory vaccination. Right, skip on again. Autonomy. Protection of autonomy has been held by the Supreme Court to mean that a competent adult patient can refuse medical treatment no matter the consequences. This is a cornerstone of constitutional, medical and human rights law. But where a contagious disease threatens public health, necessary intervention might override individual rights. Now, this woman, let's give her her proper name, Sarah Fullan McQuillan, Professor of Constitutional Law at UCD. She then presents the actual law. Where a contagious disease threatens public health, necessary intervention might override individual rights. She writes, this significant exception was recognised by the Supreme Court in 1995 in relation to Article 40.3. In 2011, the European Court of Human Rights made a similar acknowledgement in relation to Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Autonomy and bodily integrity also underpin the fact that a patient must give consent to medical treatment. Again, the Supreme Court in 1995 suggested that in relation to contagious diseases, medical treatment might be given without consent. A clear message emerges that individual self-determination in respect of healthcare decisions is to be protected if the decision affects only that patient. If the decision has consequences for public health in the context of a contagious disease, a court might override an individual's rights. This caused quite a stir, this opinion piece in the Times. Again, Professor of Constitutional Law at University College Dublin, the woman is Sarah Fullan McQuillan. And we'll talk more about that with John Waters very, very shortly. Peter Hitchens pops into the studios of Talk Radio, or he phones in, or he Skypes in once a week to speak with Mike Graham. And today, Hitchens is fed up looking at folks with masks, and he wants to talk about that. Peter Hitchens, of course, who writes opinion pieces for the Mail on Sunday these days.
I find the whole sight of people walking about is so distressing. They look so strangled and pathetic.
Right, and there's more of them now.
And submissive.
Yeah.
And I feel I'm surrounded. And the thing, I've been racking my brains as I argue with people about this. What is it that is so frightful about it? And why do I object to it so much? And it came to me that this is actually compelled speech. If you wear one of these things, you are making an expression of support. Mm. For the government's whole policy. You're saying, I am actually supporting the government's Canute-like policy of trying to control the spread of a virus by extremely oppressive measures on personal life. And it's like being compelled under the threat of a fine to wear a great big badge saying, I support the government and its policy.
Yeah. Well, I would differ from you slightly there. I mean, I would say that that would be the case perhaps if you were wearing one all the time. I mean, I take a slightly more relaxed view, which is that if I'm on public transport and they want me to wear a mask, I'll wear one. I don't go on it that often. It doesn't really affect me too much. If I now have to wear one to go into a shop, I'll do it because that's what they want me to do.
Mm. The World Health Organization today declared COVID to be the most severe health emergency it has ever faced. Yes. Yes. A lot of that on the BBC. A lot of that on Sky News. On Channel 4 today, ITV, it's everywhere. A lot of talk about vaccine trials and going well and all of that. This is where it's going. More on this, of course, as I said, in a few minutes with the Irish journalist John Waters. Let's move on, shall we? Nearly 14 minutes past the hour, Monday's programme. Let's talk about Emma Barnett. Emma Barnett. She is a presenter, and I use the term advisedly, for BBC Radio 5. Now, you'll remember Emma Barnett for her atrocious conduct when interviewing the Irish writer Kevin Myers a few years ago. Wouldn't let him answer a question, tried to humiliate him, and came off sounding like a fish wife. Looking like one too, it must be said, because as radio is dead, they've all got cameras in their studios now, which ain't radio really, is it? She came off so badly, interviewing Kevin Myers, that the Telegraph newspaper, its editorial, strongly criticised her conduct in not allowing Myers to answer any of her questions. She's garbage with a capital G. Interesting woman with an interesting background. Anywho, it's a show that I would avoid like the plague, but this morning I made it my business to listen. Why? Well, because grime star Wiley Grime, eh? Are you into a bit of grime? Do you like a bit of grime? I wouldn't be able to describe what grime is. It's urban music with rap and some sort of soundtrack to it that's pretty grungy, is it? I haven't a clue. I'm so old now, I'm totally irrelevant. What I listen to, you know, is rather embarrassing. But grime, Wiley is allegedly the godfather of grime, but he's into Doghouse. He had a bit of a meltdown on Friday and published some anti-Semitic tweets, which was discussed everywhere over the weekend. I was going to get into it on Sunday View yesterday, but I ran out of time. So, how would self-professed, non-observant Jew, Emma Barnett, cover this? Keep in mind now, and it's very important when we talk about these things, keep in mind that Emma Barnett and her show is on the BBC. Keep in mind that the BBC claims, it does claim, that it sets the highest standard in the world of journalism in terms of impartiality.
What kind of fuckery?
I know, Amy. I know, I'm not saying I agree that the BBC sets the standard in terms of journalistic integrity. I'm not saying that. It's the BBC claims it. And its presenters are supposed to remain impartial at all times. Monologues are banned on the BBC. It's written into presenters' contracts. They are not to opine on things. They're not to. They are meant to hold themselves to this fantasy standard that the BBC claims it adheres to itself. In other words, no matter how strongly a presenter feels about anything, he or she should keep their own big beak out of it and let their guests debate it and let their audience do the same. So Emma Barnett was on holidays. How did she open her programme this morning in the wake of what Wiley said about Jews on Friday? Here's Emma Barnett.
Good morning. It's good to be back. I don't know what you were up to on Friday. Me, I was eating some chippy chips, bread and butter. And
she was eating some chippy chips and bread and butter. This is the BBC in 2020. She was eating some chippy chips and bread and butter. Chippy chips. There you are. Anybody can present for the BBC, honestly.
What you were up to on Friday.
Anybody.
Me, I was eating some chippy chips, bread and butter, and some scampi in Norfolk on my
lovely
holidays. And to you, I return today.
Thank God you're back.
Unbeknownst to me, though, on Friday, the last day of my holiday, and perhaps even to many of you, a bloke called Wiley, often referred to as the godfather of grime, a very successful musician from East London who's been awarded an MBE for his services to music, was beginning a stream of foul anti-Semitism on social media, specifically Twitter. Some of his now-removed tweets read like they're straight out of the Hitler playbook of 1930s Nazi Germany.
The Hitler playbook of 1930s Nazi Germany. You are listening to a BBC primetime radio programme. Really? What did he say that was straight out of Hitler's playbook? It must have been diabolical. Well, she helpfully reads some of the tweets for you and me.
The regime this country so bravely went into battle and defeated. Let me give you a flavour of them.
Give us a flavour.
I haven't had a look at these messages. Jewish people are cowards. Do something to me. I'm waiting. Jewish people act rough, but they hide behind the police. Who writes the laws? Who changes the laws? Who implements new laws? Who? What is the five percenters? Who are they all? Who runs the world? Who runs the banks? Who writes the law book? Who hides behind the police? Who owns the police? That was Wiley tweeting about Jews.
Wow. Kill him! Burn him! It sounds to me like Wiley was pissed. Or he was smoking a bit of the funny, the wacky-backy maybe. Sounds like Wiley was really cheesed off at somebody. Right? And had a few beers or had a spliff. And, well, what else does she say?
I caught up with these messages last night, 48 hours later, when I started to think about work this week and catch up on the news agenda.
The news agenda. The news agenda, just remember that.
Those words burn. I'm sure I don't need to tell most of you that, but just in case I do, they burn deep.
This is the BBC you're listening to now.
Deeply dispiriting, and they play on a very well-hidden fear a lot of Jewish people have. That someday...
Who is she speaking for now? A lot of Jewish people.
Someday anti-Semitism will rise up
once
more. Because anti-Semitism is fresh and so raw for us. To tell you this, to take you into my life.
Let's go into her life.
Mother escaped the Nazis from Wiener Neustadt in Austria and found sanctuary as a housemaid in this country.
Yeah, I tell you what... God love your grandmother escaping the Nazis. Must have been absolutely dreadful. Couldn't imagine it. Couldn't imagine it, the bravery of some of these people. Why don't you talk about your daddy, Emma? Maybe not.
My husband's grandmother survived unspeakable torture in
Auschwitz. This is the BBC you're listening to.
Auschwitz, in Europe.
Garbage. Right, this is garbage.
A two-hour flight from here. I've been there. He can't go. He can't bear it. These were our grandmothers who read us bedtime stories safe in our beds in this country.
Your grandmother read you bedtime stories because your father was trafficking in girls in Manchester. Isn't that right, Emma?
This happened to them in their lifetime. People I met and loved.
Yeah.
Only 2 weeks ago, a week before I went away, I opened Twitter on my phone. What did I see? I saw Jewish privilege trending. Do you know how that feels?
I would imagine it feels... the way I feel when white privilege is trending. I couldn't give a shit, really. Because there isn't anything that any human being could say to me or about me or about my country or about my countrymen and women that would bother my hairy little arse the slightest bit. Sticks and stones, love. You know, this is dire, this, isn't it?
Do you know how frightening that is? How angering that is?
You're very soft, love, if... the rantings of a grime artist on Twitter on Friday hurts you and frightens you, I would have said.
I've had my fair share of abuse online.
You deserved most of it.
Much of it sexist and politically charged. It's all out there. You can go and have a look.
People threatened to kill me last year, love. They put my address online. They put the address and telephone number of my partner's company online. But I didn't give a shit. I dealt with it. Emma Barnett, it gets worse. You can't imagine it, but it does.
Why are we talking about this today, then? 48 hours
good question.
On from what Wiley did. Well, there's a walkout of Twitter by thousands of people around the world under the hashtag No Safe Space for Jew Hate. It started at 9 o'clock, an hour or so ago. and will go on for 48 hours. And while there is a very important point to be discussed around the role of unregulated social media platforms to act swiftly and remove racist messages, something Twitter didn't do quickly in this instance, and we're going to come on to that, Wiley's also been banned from that platform and Instagram for a week, something else must not be missed.
I'm all ears.
Missed.
Come on.
Why is a 41-year-old bloke from enlightened Britain attacking Jews on a random Friday?
Sounded to me like he was attacking one Jew specifically. Sounded to me like somebody... Well, it sounded to me like he particularly felt that somebody screwed him over. And he was angry. And he went on Twitter. Maybe he had imbibed before doing that. And he said a few stupid things. Enlightened Britain.
And he's not alone. So I say this to you, Wiley, if you're listening, because you can't tweet right now, you can't post on Instagram, you might be on a different platform, but if you're listening to Five Live now, and I'm on here for 3 hours most days...
Yeah, sadly.
Just in case you need something clarifying, and I'll say it really slowly...
This is utter garbage. Do you understand how bad this is? This is BBC journalism in 2020. This is a diatribe, the likes of which I didn't even think the BBC could stoop so low as to present as news. This is diabolical.
And really clearly, Jews don't run the law. Jews don't run the banks.
Well, we'll come back to that.
Jews don't run, as you put it, the world. I hate to disappoint you and anyone else who got your anti-Semitic memo, but it ain't true.
Goes on, it gets even more surreal.
A man who enjoys huge success, has legions of fans. I want to know, where did he get that anti-Semitic memo from? Where did he get those messages from? I'm not interested in apologies.
Why not?
I'm not interested in him coming back on Twitter.
Why not?
I'm not interested in what he's going to do in his next album.
Why not? Doesn't he get a chance to explain himself? Or is he tried, convicted, and ultimately then executed, at least metaphorically, by social media and by morons like you, Emma? Is that how you want the world to be? A guy said some very stupid things about Jews. They run the world. Yeah, of course Jews don't run the world. They run the police. Yeah, of course they don't. Guy was pissed off about something. Had a bit of a rant. Does he not get a chance to explain himself or to say, listen, this was the frame of mind I was in, you know? Or do we just bury him and say he's finished and put him into some sort of cyber exile forever? Is that how it goes now in 2020?
Maybe he's going to find himself or anyone else who's been through this process. I'm actually interested in where did it come from and curing society.
But you're not interested in where it came from because you don't want to hear from him. You don't want him back on Twitter. You certainly don't want to provide a space for him on your programme. So you're not really that curious about why he said what he said on Friday. I am, because I'm a real journalist. I want to find out whether he is a bigoted twerp who just hates Jews, or if the guy was having some sort of fucking meltdown. If he has a relationship with a Jewish person that has gone particularly sour and he's just ranting. I'd like to know that, you know. Context, in my life anyway, as a journalist, as a real journalist, still has some place in 2020. Let's give the chap a chance to defend himself. Nah.
Of such racism.
It's not racism, it's bigotry.
But can we? Or do we always have to just accept that certain people, even those with the benefit of wealth and success and advisors, I mean, he has managers, he has people around him, even those with thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers, millions in some people's cases, will always be deeply prejudiced.
You do have to accept that, love, yeah. I made this point to Peter Tatchell. You can't change thoughts, you can't police thoughts, nor do you have the right, nor should you ever have the right to attempt to do so. People are entitled to think and feel how they think and feel, so long as they don't deny anybody else. Tough shit, love. It's the way of the world. I get it from people. I see it from people on social media who blame either the Jews for everything that ever went wrong in their lives. If they don't blame the Jews, they're blaming Muslims for it. If they're not blaming Muslims for it, they're blaming the left or they're blaming the right. It's the way the world always was. You can't police people's thoughts. You certainly can't cure them. It got even worse, this. I mean, this is scandalous, this, right? I would hope that Ofcom would have thousands of complaints, but I doubt that thousands of people listen to the programme. It is that bad, generally. It gets worse, then, because the producer and screenwriter, Jimmy McGovern, from Liverpool, felt compelled to ring in and declare that working-class people grow up with hatred for Jews and anti-Semitism in their hearts and in their lives. I'm not making it up. Listen to this.
I speak as a man who was brought up in a white working class area, I was born post-war, and I grew up to be, well, I didn't grow up as a child. I was a racist and an anti-Semite. I was everything because that's the way I was taught. That's the way I was brought up.
In a working class housing estate, he was brought up to be racist and anti-Semitic. Really? Oh, no.
Our school was white. Totally white.
Well, it would have been in Liverpool, of course.
And totally Roman Catholic.
Absolutely. It was built, Liverpool, by Irish hands.
You know, our history was white.
Absolutely.
Our history was white Christian.
Yeah, okay. I'm no longer a Christian myself. But I'm waiting for the overarching proof that the smoking gun here to suggest that you were anti-Semitic and racist because of your Liverpool working class upbringing. This is mad shit, this.
You know, Christopher Columbus discovered America. Captain Cook discovered Australia. Well, weren't the people living there already? You know, it was all white. Tarzan films. The Black and White Minstrel Show.
Tarzan films, Weissmuller and the Black and White Minstrels. That made us racist because that stuff was on our TV screens.
It was all white and racist.
It was all white and racist.
That was my childhood. So, of course, I became... I became a racist child.
I became a racist child. Now, of course, Barnett is useless, right? We know that. She's absolutely decrepit, rubbish. If she was any good, if she had a brain in her head and was a real journalist, she'd say, Jimmy, as far as I know, some of the biggest anti-fascists ever were working-class trade unionist men and women. The Jews have never had any greater friends than working class trade unionists. And of course, I know this to be true, having grown up in an area where we voted Socialist Workers' Party and Sinn Féin. Everybody was active. Yes, they were very much, how do I put it, motivated to speak up for the rights of Palestine and for Palestinians. Of course they were. Absolutely right and proper too, but they were very quick to stand up against anti-Semitism or any instances of it. And of course Barnett, if she had a clue, would say, hang on a second, it's a bit harsh that, you know, traditionally working class areas, Jewish people, you know, trade unionists, always been friends, always had support there. But Barnett doesn't. She congratulates him.
That's a very powerful thing to say like that. I don't know.
It's not powerful, it's fucking stupid is what it is.
If I've ever heard anybody say like that before.
Well, I don't think any man of my age who grew up in a working class community could say that's not the case. Any white working class male would.
Well, I can. It certainly wasn't the case in Ballybeg in Waterford City where I grew up. It certainly wasn't the case in Lisdougan when we moved to Lisdougan, Browns Road in 1986. Another huge working class area. Wasn't the case there either. This is crazy, this.
Would have to say yes.
But, I mean, wouldn't some people dispute that from the point of view of the war, what was fought against in Germany, against fascism, that being a big part of the psyche as well?
But just look at the culture of the time, the 50s and the 60s. Tarzan films, Black and White Minstrel Show, white history. You know, it was all white. White and Christian.
And let me ask you then this question that I've been asking our listeners. Do you think people then can be cured of those views? Like somebody like Wiley, this grime artist that's been banned from social media platforms, you don't have to comment specifically on him, but he's got a memo from somewhere. In this instance, it's anti-Semitic, but it could have been Islamophobic. It could have been any form of prejudice. Do you think people can be cured?
Cured.
Can be cured.
I don't know. You need somebody wiser than me to comment on that, I'm afraid.
Well, touche, 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 touche. Hey, wow. I have nothing else to say about that. This is the Saw Doctors, 27 minutes to the top of the hour. John Waters is in the house and will be with me after this marvellous bit of music. Yeah, a lot of comment on Twitter about that Emma Barnett rant on BBC Radio 5 Live earlier. If you want to continue talking about that, just go to Twitter and where it says search Twitter, put my name in there and press enter and you'll see the tweets that have come in on that subject. Bizarre stuff. It really is. But anyway, we'll leave that there for now. My guest needs very little introduction. Great to welcome him back to the programme. He's a very, very gifted Irish writer, journalist, author and broadcaster. And it's been great to get to know him in the last few months in these, well, very, very serious and very, very, I think, dangerous times. Let's welcome him back to the show. He's in Sligo today, the one and only John Waters. John, welcome back to the show, mate. Thanks for taking the time to speak to us. How are you?
Hello, Richie. Not too bad. Thanks. Not too bad.
We have a kind of a poor connection. We have a poor connection there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to very quickly hang up and call again. Sometimes works that. It kind of clears the decks when you hang up and reconnect. So let's hope it works. And keep your fingers crossed. Yes, John, I just disconnected there, Richie. There you are. I think it might be better now. Lovely. Yes. Are you there? You are. Can you hear me?
I'm here.
Brilliant.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Thanks, John. Yeah, the first connection was very poor and we could barely hear you. Listen,
atmospheric.
You mentioned that might be a problem. We're in we're in very dangerous times. I sent you a link to an article, which you probably would have seen anyway, in the Irish Times this morning.
Yeah.
Written by an Irish academic, professor of constitutional law at UCD, making the case that the Constitution, rather than protect the individual right of body integrity, actually might be slanted to protect the right of the state to medicate somebody against his or her will if it meant that it was for the greater good. What did you make of that article, John?
Well, to first of all say, Richie, that I wouldn't have seen it anyway because I don't read that rag anymore.
Right.
I used to work for it. It was a decent newspaper once, but it's not now. It's a deeply corrupt newspaper which is paid for by basically state advertising basically pays their wages. So, I've heard this argument. This is part of the propaganda campaign that they've been running, you know. Now, and I'm not entirely discounting the possibility that it may turn out to be right, but it will turn out to be right for entirely the same reasons that this is corrupt in the first place. Like, you see, the Irish Constitution protects absolutely in lots and lots of ways the personal rights of the human person. But there are some caveats entered in that Constitution, as there would be. But they always have to be justified by the factual situation. And indeed, in the history of the Constitution, there is a long litany of cases where there were attempts to made to extend, for example, the state of emergency to include other than what it now encompasses and now requires, which is either a war or an armed rebellion. But in this situation, they've introduced what I call, for the lockdown, an emergency with a small e. Which in my opinion and in the submission, my submission to the courts is entirely unconstitutional. But this is the same kind of thinking. And, you know, I would say, yes, you see, I would have, with the caliber of judges that were available, even up to a decade ago, I would have rested easy in my bed that article is complete nonsense. But that article may now be written on the basis of conversations with judges who have no attachment whatever to the Constitution, who want to undermine the Constitution, and who can basically make up a stream of gibberish and put it down in a judgment. And because the media is corrupt, it will pass muster because everybody is basically duped. You said that these are terrible times. Well, we have to define what is the nature of the horror that has descended us. What are the ingredients? Well, we could go on at that for some length, but let us begin with the fact that the people have been turned into cattle in their minds, that they're no longer capable, it seems to me, of thinking and of even laughing. I think, you know, even the normal kind of human responses seem to be affected by what's actually happening now. which is a culmination of a series of decades, I'd say, certainly years, two decades maybe, of attack here in Ireland anyway, on people's very beings, very core, very belief systems. And they've been basically turned into kind of automatons. I was in Westport yesterday, in the west of Ireland, where I worked one of my first jobs when I was a very young man in my late teens. And I worked in the railway station there. Beautiful town, beautiful people. I mean, you know, Rich, you know what I mean when I say this, that it was the kind of the people, you know, when you meet a fella or a woman on the side of the road or in a pub or in a coffee shop, and immediately there's like a fire between you, a fire of connection, a fire of humor, a fire of understanding, you know, that you're suddenly sparking on a different level than you would be in a normal kind of strained conversation at a dinner party, say, or, you know, I don't know. You know, this is like, this is the uniqueness of the Irish personality. Not unique, no, that's not fair. The other people have their other ways of doing it, but we have a particular way of doing it. And we call it the crack. And we don't actually spell it in the way they spell it now, C-R-A-I-C. We always spelled it C-R-A-C-K. It's an Anglo-Norman word. And that's where we get it from. And you see, that level of intelligence is the level of intelligence to do that is very high, you know, that you need to be able to have empathy and understanding of the other person. Now, in my experience, I was in Westport yesterday and I went around, and that was the most dismaying thing I was discovering, was that that's almost all gone, that people I was meeting, and I won't kind of say what category, because in fairness to them, God help them, you know, they're affected deeply by corrupt media and particularly by the national broadcaster. But there, that whole dimension of the personality was gone. It was it was like trying to light a fire with a box of soggy matches. Because whenever you actually said something to them, they would just literally kind of go, oh, you know. The only thing that would animate them, I think, was anything to do with money. Good or bad. Like if you said something, like that, God, the hotels must have lost a lot of money the last, well, they'd be going then, like, you know.
Yeah.
But anything else, they were not able to respond in any kind of, I would say, enthusiastic way. Now, I don't know, maybe there's some element of medication involved in this also, but I think we have a real problem in terms of the very existential being of the human person as a result of the kind of culture we have developed now. And what's going on is really, at the moment, a kind of an escalation of that, a way of, I suppose, shortening the journey for them, you know, that they want to take us from, they've taken us from, say, A to Q. Well, they certainly have taken us to Q, but they now want to take us to a Z in the quickest, shortest, in the shortest possible time. And they're going to do it with this kind of methodology.
What does Z look like, John? What does Z look like? What sort of world will Z be, do you think?
Well, we will be like zombies. We will be terrified of our own shadows. We will be under night and daily monitoring, surveillance. We will be watching each other, snitching on each other. We've seen some of it in this time, in the lockdown. We will not be able to think for ourselves. We will be reciting lines from the television, you know. That will be our conversation. You know, that extraordinary explosion that used to occur between two people in Ireland or elsewhere, in other places, because you know, you could do it with an Englishman as well. You know, he would have his own language of humor, you know. And suddenly you have an eruption of laughter would occur. And you would just walk away from that encounter, a very short encounter sometimes, walk away feeling like you were like floating on air with the connectivity that you had just experienced. That's going. That's going. And that's what they're about, these people, these sinister beings that I've spoken about so many times who are now leading. Well, the people leading us in Ireland, I can't really speak for the people. I'm bemused by Boris Johnson. I cannot. He is inscrutable to me at this point. But our own people are so dumb that they just do what they're told and pass on the torture and the tyranny to us. For other peoples, I can't really say because I'm not that familiar with them. But say Boris Johnson, I would have thought of him as a very exceptionally witty man, a very intelligent man. He has acted like a moron for the past several months now, you know. I watched him and I think, God, is this man broken by something? Is he broken by the illness he had? How serious was the illness? Was it serious enough to take away his sense of humor, to take away his intelligence, to take away his humanity? I don't know. I look at him now and I think, what is left? Very little, I think, you know. Very, very little.
And that obviously brings us around to who these people are really. I mean, you mentioned the Irish government. I, for some time, believed that the Irish government are basically essentially front men and women for Brussels. And the people in Brussels are front men and women for the central banking cartels. And I wonder, you've described Johnson brilliantly there in terms of, you know, yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't have any time for any politician. But yeah, the guy over the years has been very quick with a witty line. He's obviously not stupid. He's had a bit of charm about him. And what you've seen in recent months is you've basically seen a guy beaten down, sometimes looking very bewildered at the things that he's saying himself. And that you have to, I don't say you have to, but I find myself having to contemplate that nothing is as it seems, and that these people are not now and never were actually running things. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do think that. Certainly, I think that in Ireland. I would be surprised to think that, you know, Margaret Thatcher, for example, going back, wasn't running things. I think she was. After that, you're in kind of trouble, you know, being certain what I mean. I mean, Cameron, yes, I can buy into the idea that Cameron, you know, was not really running Britain. Major, yes, I can buy that also, you know. You know, Theresa May, absolutely, obviously, you know. But insofar as Irish leaders are concerned, you know, we've long been, you see, and it's more complicated than simply that they are the agents of say, Brussels. Or they're the agents of anybody who wants something of Ireland. Agents within Ireland to break up Ireland, that piece of Ireland, and hand it to them, to break it off. And that's essentially, now that's a long tradition in Ireland going back hundreds of years. There were all, and I talk about that on Kirkpatrick yesterday. I gave a speech up there when I talked about the Quisling city of Dublin, which has long been seen as its means of survival being the selling out of the rest of the country. And that's our problem. Politician. I come from Westport or Castlebar, which is about as decent a place. You know, I've always found those people extraordinary. He came from Castlebar, but it was of no help to us that he was in Castlebar when he got to Dublin, because he turned into the greatest Quisling that we ever saw, being prepared to sell us down the river to the European Commission, to the corporate sector of America, to the banks, you know, to the European Central Bank. You name it, like if somebody comes in, like the latest racket joke, Richie, I'm telling you, but it's not at all a joke.
The line is really bad there. So what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to take a tune and I'm going to try and connect to John another way. Apologies for the quality of the line. He's in Sligo and he said there might be an issue with it today. We'll see, can we get him on the phone instead of the Skype? That'll make it easier, I think. Back in a minute after this. Really important stuff, this. John Waters, great Irish writer, broadcaster as well. Formerly, as he said, amongst other parishes, he was a writer for the Irish Times. Let's have Radiohead, and hopefully we'll get John Waters back on a better line in a minute. It's Monday's Richie Allen Show, by the way. Monday, hey, these things always happen on a Monday. We'll sort it out, no bother. Right, let's get rid of Radiohead there. Tom York won't mind, I suppose. It's 10 minutes to 6 o'clock, and I hope we've got a better connection with John Waters. John, it's a Monday, and lots of academic studies have been done about things going wrong on Monday, so we just have to put up with it. I hope we're back. Yeah, listen, can you hear me now? I hope you can.
I can hear you, Richard. Yeah, I can hear you.
Lovely, good stuff. Again, sorry about this. If you are just joining us, John Waters is our guest. And we've been talking about the article in the Irish Times today, the Irish Constitution. And John was talking about a speech he gave in Kirkpatrick yesterday, where he talked about the selling out of Ireland. We were talking about politicians as front men and women for something maybe a bit more sinister, for the European Union, for other institutions. I think, John, I like kind of segueing from one thing to another. I think there's a lot to this idea that financiers like Jeffrey Epstein and others, you know, have over the years kept politicians honest by compromising them in some way, whether it be through their sexual deviancy or whether it be through illegal financial dealings, I've come to really believe that you can't ascend through the main political parties of Europe or even America unless you are compromised in some way. I don't know how you feel about that. It might be a bit conspiratorial for you.
No, I don't think so, Richie. I don't think the word conspiratorial. I think that word's been kiboshed by very cunning ideologues, because there's nothing wrong with actually having a theory about a conspiracy if such a conspiracy might conceivably exist. And you know, for that reason, to call somebody a conspiracy theorist is merely to say that they are alert to all kinds of dangers in their society and in their vicinity. But I have to accuse myself here of terrible naivety down through the years in not recognizing that these things were happening. This is what the Epstein story has told us, that indeed this is very, very likely to have been the defining factor in the shaping of our societies through our lives. Not democracy, not the wishes of the people, but this syndrome which has actually taken our politicians prisoner, morally, ethically, and in other ways, and has held them to their own ransom. So, I do think that's very, very plausible. And I do think that, the signs of it are to be seen in some of this extraordinary events now that's occurring. Because clearly what is occurring is beyond the line of criminality, at the very, very least. When you have a situation where people now are being forced as though they were prisoners in a concentration camp to go around wearing pieces of rags on their faces under the lie that this is actually preventing them getting sick or preventing anybody getting sick. You know, you just think about it, Richie. I mean, it's a variation on the whole history of criminality. You know, the idea of the mask has always been part of criminality.
Yeah.
You know, highway mask. You know, the bank robber. You know, the nylon stocking over the head, the balaclava. You know, these are now we have a variation, a twist on this, where it is actually the innocent who wear the mask. And the reason it's the same thing, it's to create an alibi for the people who are committing the crime, because the crime has been that a minor flu has been grossly exaggerated by politicians, scientists, and bureaucrats to an extent that has caused unbelievable carnage in the economies and in the lives of many, many millions of people in the world, maybe billions of people. That they are, through the lie of COVID-19, that it is a deadly disease, that can strike people down in the street. I think, and we can go into that if you want, because it's more subtle than people realize. The COVID-19 is now emerges. It's now clear. If you're paying attention, it is now clear that actually COVID-19 is just the same as a normal flu, an average middle-of-the-range flu. And, of course, it can adversely affect people who are seriously immunocompromised. That has always been the case with flus. And so what's actually happening, though, people have started to believe that they themselves... I mean, people are jumping out of each other's way in the street. I've seen it today, a man. I was almost like, for a moment, as I was going to go into a kind of a tango thing, with him. Like he was dancing so much, and this is terribly sad because it is a terrible affront on the intelligence of the person, of the human person, and on the dignity of the human person. But fundamentally, it is to keep the criminality going, because the very moment that it is discovered that people have been conned, they will realize that their grandmothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles were allowed to die alone. Great pain and great human and emotional pain because of all the multiple factors that were at play, including that they couldn't find a priest despite their intense belief in whatever faith they held. That these people will, once they realize the enormity of this crime, they will be absolutely, I think it's pitchfork time. You know, it's time to get the pitchfork from the shed and march upon Dublin or London. That's the kind of moment. And that's what the mask is about. It's about trying to delay that moment until they can come up with some other scam. You see, that's essentially what they're doing now. And it's succeeding. You have to see it. As I said yesterday, I saw this very clearly, that people, there's nothing now you won't get people to do. These politicians have people in the power of their hand, mainly through their offices of corrupt media, who have control of the minds of people. from morning till night and from night till morning. It's a terrible, terrible situation. People need to really understand now that this is an outright, and I didn't believe this in the beginning, but I believe it now, what I'm about to say. It is an outright hoax, an outright scam. It is a spook. It is the deaths by and large. And there's a very good video that people might want to look at. An excellent doctor. I'm not sure where he's from. He might be American, but his name is Dennis Rank.
Rancourt, is it?
Rancourt, exactly. Sorry, I beg your pardon. Rancourt. And it's a 15-minute video. And he goes through the whole thing in a couple of broad strokes. And he shows you how it was done. And one of the things he draws attention to, Richie, which is very startling, and which has perplexed me from the very beginning, because in all countries and across Europe and across the world, the spike, we use the word spike in relation to the numbers of deaths in, say, a flu in January, February, or whatever it would be. And normally, you know, the word spike is quite inappropriate, because when you see it drawn out, it's almost like a mountain range. It's not like one peak. It's generally, it's a series of peaks, minor peaks. It's literally like a part of the Pyrenees or something like that, a bad drawing of the Pyrenees. Now, the thing about it is, in COVID, for the COVID-19, it is actually a spike. It is like an icicle going upwards. And it's very slim, very, very slim indeed, which means that the period from which the deaths began to happen and they ended, it's very short, something like 6 weeks. And he traces it from the last week in March to the first week in May. And it goes right up. And it goes somewhat higher at the top than the highest recent peak of flu.
But not that much, but it's an extraordinarily slim spike at that point. And the way he explains it is that he says this all happened in pretty much in nursing homes, that the conditions created in those nursing homes by this panic and the sense that something terrible was happening around the last week in March, where you had people locked in, very, very vulnerable people, people with delicate constitutions, delicate, immune systems, and that locked in where the air was bad and there was no sunlight and they couldn't get in touch with their families, or the families couldn't come to see them. And you just think further. This is my slight additional spin to it. Many of those people, by definition, would have been of an age where their religious faith was deeply intense. And what was happening? The churches were declaring that the priests should not go and visit the sick.
That's right.
And they were left there feeling that, you know, they were about to depart this world without the comfort of the hand of their loved ones, but also without the administration of a priest. What would that have done to the psyche of a person who really believed in God and believed in all this?
It would have been devastating. It would have devastated them.
So this is a crime beyond description, really, Richie, at innumerable levels.
And that's essentially what the masks are about. They're about putting a mask on the face of everybody so that the nature of the crime can be concealed for a little longer. But I don't think it can be controlled indefinitely, because the figures have not yet emerged of the actual scale of what they've done to the economies of the world. And I know there are theories about the reset and that they actually did this deliberately, but I don't know. I cannot believe that anybody is that stupid. I cannot believe that they think that an economy is something you can, press one button, turn it off, and then press another button and turn it on. It doesn't work like that.
Imagine, sorry to interrupt you, John. Imagine, and again, it's something to contemplate without I suppose, endorsing. But imagine it's not the case that they're stupid. Imagine again that they're clever or semi-clever, that they've longed for a long time to have this type of power over the movements of people and over what people put into their bodies, then it doesn't look as stupid. I mean, it's a fact here that the government produced a report last week saying that, you know, it's fair to assume that 200,000 people will die because of the imposition of the lockdown. Now, I've had arguments with people on social media. I don't argue that vociferously. I tend to be fairly, you know, laid back about it. But I've said to them, you know, you're talking about 50,000 deaths, which is an exaggeration anyway. But are you saying that you are willing to kill 200,000 people? You know, if it's, you'd rather 200,000 people died than 50,000, even if 50,000 was accurate. The death figures, of course, have been grossly exaggerated. And you made a very good point. The vast majority of people died locked into care homes. So I contend, and I'm certainly not the writer or the intellect that you are, but I've worked at every level of the media for most of my life. I've had good jobs in the media, and I'm a reasonably bright fella. And I've reached a conclusion that scares the living shit out of me most nights I go to bed. I've reached a conclusion that the consequences of this are intended consequences. It's not a mistake. It's what they want, and who they or what they is, well, we could debate that all night long. But that's how I feel, John, today.
Well, you won't meet an argument from me on that. You know, I'm not going to take the other side of that, Richie. What my positions are based on what I can see in plain sight. And if I can't join pieces up, I tend not to move that extra.
Yeah, fair
piece
enough.
Off. So and I think that's the kind of a thing you get from journalism in a way. You know that you you know there's only so much you can stack that stacks up efficiently to put it into print. And I'm the same with this, but I don't necessarily rule out what you've said. And I'm all the time looking at the facts and looking at them again to see. You know, I do think that there is a chain of command, undoubtedly. And I think that by the time it gets to the kind of gobshites that run Ireland, then probably is a deficiency of information. They don't know what's going on. They think they're actually doing what they say they're doing, more or less. But I do agree. I do think it's very possible that at a higher level, that there is a room of Machiavellian minds at work. But, you know, on the other hand, when I see someone like, say, Bill Gates and I listen to him, I don't see any evidence of intelligence, you know.
Yeah.
I see evidence of, but not much of intelligence. But you see, I think this is the, but the extraordinary thing, though, what you've said there as well, Richie, about that 200,000 figure that emerged last week, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression I'm getting from over here, that actually happened, was reported in a certain sense, and then more or less dissipated.
Ignored.
There was no
outcry.
There was no outcry about it.
No debate about it.
That's actually, you just compare that to the outcry that was when that idiot from Imperial College predicted that there would be a death number of deaths. I can't remember what it was. 500,000, I think it was.
Ferguson, you're making a very good point there. Professor Neil Ferguson, good.
So this fictitious 500,000 could cause horror and bring the country to its knees. But the real figure, which we had no doubt about it, and it was unquestionably it's an underestimate because it only counts certain categories, that 200,000 people will die directly over the next few years as a consequence of the lockdown. Now, we know all the categories that would happen under. You know, obviously, immediately and in the immediate future, suicides, deaths of despair from the people who have lost their businesses, their jobs, their lives. You know, the numbers of people who have been denied screening and testing for various diseases in the last 4 months. And we know many of those, both personally, I do anyway, and so on. So, you know, this is a real figure. And yet it has received no attention. Now, isn't that interesting? This is what I mean by corruption, Richie, in the media. The same thing happened here a couple of weeks ago in Ireland, where a group called HICWA, connected with the health service, their investigative agency in relation to health issues. And they did a survey. I'm not sure why they did it or how they were prevailed upon to do it, but it was very interesting and excellent in its own way, because they found that the fatality figure, which was at that time something like 1,700, obviously Ireland is a much smaller country than the UK, so our figures are smaller, 1,700 odd fatalities, allegedly, and that's issued with the caveat and the proviso that, of course, most of those, or many of those, are actually not genuine COVID deaths at all. But that was the official figure. And then they announced that this figure had been overestimated by to the tune of 60%, which brought the actual figure down to 1,072 deaths, right? That's a hell of a drop, like. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't reported. That's the interesting thing. It was reported. But it was reported the way, you know, a man falls off a bicycle used to be reported in the local paper one time. You know, get four lines on page 17. And that was the measure of its reporting. And then what happened was even more interesting, because then it was forgotten. And if you look now on Wikipedia, or if you look on the gov.ie website, which is the Government of Ireland website, or if you look at the RTE website, the national broadcaster, you'll find they're still using the 1,700 figure.
They're still using the incorrect figure. Let me just explain to our listeners what John is talking about there. I've worked in broadcast media for the best part of the last 21, 22 years. John's an outstanding and greatly accomplished writer. What he's explaining there is these figures come out, you know, that 60%, it's overestimated by 60%. It's a massive story. It gets a mention. As John said, it's almost written like a guy falls off a bicycle. What used to happen, and I was speaking to my better half this morning in the park as we were getting absolutely pissed on in the rain in Salford this morning. I was explaining to Caroline, my oft-mentioned other half, the way it used to work was this would come out and the papers would go to town on it and the opinion piece writers would tear it apart and would go for the government. What's happening now is 200,000 people might die or will die, says the government, because of the lockdown. There's nothing in the Telegraph. There's nothing in the Times. There's nothing. It just dies away. It's like it's chip paper before the day is even over. It's crazy. Years ago, you'd have been on the Times taking it to the cleaners, John.
That's exactly it, Richie, because you see, think through the effect of that thing, you see, because the ordinary guy or woman on the Clapham omnibus, as the judge once famously said, the reasonable man or woman on the Clapham omnibus, like, they're kind of, you know, they're busy, they're living with their lives, they look at the headlines on the paper and see what's happened. Is there an earthquake or a plane crash or something like that? And if there isn't, if it's like a man falls off bicycle in Clapham, then they reckon the world is in reasonably decent order today, so I can go on with my life.
Yeah.
Now, when they don't see anything about 200,000 at all, then they don't know about it. If they happen to see the item on page 17 that says that they think, well, that's a very small story. It can't be all that important. I don't need to take that on board. And what actually happens is it's kind of nothing to see here syndrome. It infects the people. Or they think, and when you ask, I found this, asking about the figures in Ireland and that reduction of 60%. I said, did you see that? They did see it, you see. This is the interesting thing. They did actually see it. They said, oh, yeah, I saw something about that. All right. But they haven't, because there was no emphasis placed on it, it hasn't registered as anything important, as anything significant. And this is what the journalism of today does, you see. It actually not just denies people the information, it does that as well, but it actually prints the information in a certain way so as to make it seem insignificant.
Yeah, that's right.
And therefore has no significance, no resonance in the culture.
None of the political heavyweights in the UK, namely Laura Koonsberg, namely Beth Rigby at Sky, Robert Peston, Nick Robinson on Radio 4, none of them asked the question that I would have been asking during my days in commercial radio, which was to get the most senior government minister you could possibly get on the radio and challenge them to immediately do away with the nonsensical lockdown. Listen, by your own report, hundreds of thousands of people are going to die as a result of the lockdown. So unlock the country, stop this nonsense, and tell vulnerable people that you'll help them, you'll get them the vitamin C, the vitamin D, you look after them, that they need to be a bit careful, do away with the lockdown. That's what would have happened in days of yore. But none of these so-called great political journalists, now they're all garbage, you and I know that, none of them asked the question of Johnson or Matt Hancock or any of the other cabinet secretaries. It's like you said, you described it beautifully. It just went away. It went away. This amazing news, this huge news, you know, gone. And we carry on. We carry on with more stupid comments from Johnson that we'll be living with this till the middle of next year, which basically means another year, and that we'll all have to take the vaccine. And yet, it's just nonsense. Everything about this is a hoax, as you said earlier on. And here we are.
What do you think? Yeah, but when you look away, see, I suppose it's because I worked in the media, just as you've worked in the media all your life, and you're watching these things, and so you actually see how the trick is done. It's like as if we are ourselves conjurers.
Magicians,
And we say, well, how's he doing that, you know? Well, like, you can see, for example, another trick they use, and I'm watching this in the New York Times. New York Times has been running a map of the world and of the United States for the last 4 months, and they rank the countries in terms of gravity of or appear to rank the countries in terms of gravity of disease or whatever, or spread of disease or whatever. Now, that in the beginning, I spotted that actually what they were doing was they were ranking them on a
an absolute number basis, which inevitably put the United States at the top of the chart every day, right? And that was deliberate because, of course, the correct way measure would be per capita. That's the only, you know, if you're measuring deaths, for example, deaths per capita, that's the only indicator. The test or new cases per capita is pretty meaningless because it all depends on testing and so on. And that varies from region to region and country to country. But deaths per capita. And then, so then we see what they've now started to do. And if you look at it, you know, I was watching, looking the other day, and I said, God almighty, the United States has disappeared down this line. You know, I forget who's up on top now. Might be Brazil or somebody. But you see, then you see they've changed the methodology. They're no longer test. They're no longer counting in the same way. They're counting now tests basically every day.
Yeah.
And breaking it down into regions and local counties and all this sort of stuff. And so the methodology has changed in a way to get the result that they want, because they know, again, that the casual reader will be hurriedly, you know, just glancing down this. And they'll see what the journalists want them to see. And so now people, for example, you know, a friend of mine, have the son's working in Florida, in Miami, and there's a lot of concern, you know, because they're hyping those figures. But when you actually look at the actual fatality figure, it's actually something like 800,000.
800,000. 800,000. Madness.
Massive hype on the foot of that. There's a massive hype on foot of that and elsewhere as well. But you see, people can't, you know, I understand. I'm not being in any way patronizing that people say they can't see through this, because it's not, that's not, see, journalists, the point of journalism, which you know, is to make things clear so people can understand picture. It's not to pull tricks on them so they will get the wrong impression.
Absolutely.
That's certainly not what
yeah. about. Your job, and I mean, you did it for years and you're still doing it now, you're doing it on this program. Your job is to find any holes in any story, whether it's from the Taoiseach of the day, whether it's from some bloke who runs a business around the corner. If they're saying things and the things they are saying are doubtful, it's your job to throw some light on that and to screw them to the wall. And all of this is going on, and what the, you know, the big presenters, Andrew Marr, BBC, Sophie Ridge, Sky News, they're rinsing and repeating. It's like they're getting these government press releases. They're rewriting them for television. They're going into the audit queue and they're reading them as if they are true. It was like the Russian interference story last week. Now look, I don't have any time for Vladimir Putin, and I don't know how I feel about that Russian interference story. I don't know anything about it. I have my suspicions about the Pentagon and GCHQ here, but that's another story. But it's the job of Sky News and the BBC to find out if there's any really hard evidence to connect the Russians to Brexit. Not to be just saying, you know, there's a lot of suspicion and there's a lot of concern about the Russians. I mean, no, that's not your job. You're not a government spokeswoman. You're supposed to be a journalist. Christ, what's happened to our business? You know, it sickens me, John. I can't sleep a lot of nights.
Yeah.
How bad it's going.
Well, it's even worse than that, Richie. And that's what in my experience now of meeting, and I limited enough experience, but some, of meeting younger journalists now. And they appear all to be advocates on behalf of government.
Yeah.
So this is astonishing to me. I mean, when I was a young journalist, I thought of myself as the enemy of power.
Yeah.
You know, my job was to unseat the government if I could, to bring down the government once a week at least, if it were possible. When we were in magazines in Ireland and Current Affairs magazine like McGill in Dublin years ago, that was our job, to bring down the government once a month. And now, you know, you have journalists arguing about face, telling people that they must wear a face mask.
Yeah.
Honest to God, I know one particular young journalist trained in a college, journalism college, who has been menacing people and threatening them because they're not wearing, including members of his own family, because they weren't wearing masks in certain situations. And this is fantastic to me. Like that's what I was talking about earlier, because that infects entire generations. Young people are, for some reason, extraordinarily susceptible to propaganda. The kind of propaganda that's been leveled now. I think it has something to do with the fact that there is a connection somewhere between all this COVID stuff and the LGBT stuff and all that, you know. There seems to be like a similar kind of treatment of those in terms of propaganda, and they come from the same kind of politicians.
and they're advocated by the same kind of language and
in the same way. It's a complicated argument.
No, it's a good argument. Do you know what I think is happening? I for some short time, did some teaching of radio production. I taught radio production for City and Guilds for a bit. And one of the things I used to speak to my... They weren't my students, they were other instructors' students, but I used to guest and do some teaching. I think, I hate to say younger people because we're still young, we're not old men, you or I. I think what's happening is the generations behind us are being conditioned to accept commentary as journalism. They expect commentary now. I get it all the time from people. I try to be balanced in my interviewing approach, even when I'm interviewing somebody whom I strongly agree with. I generally, maybe not today so much, but I generally do. And I laugh when I get emails from younger listeners who say they get annoyed because sometimes I don't take a position. Now, this is extraordinary to me. This is mind-blowing to me because I was brought up not to take a position. Like, if I was, when I sat in for my presenter on WLR years ago, if he was away and I sat in, you know, the idea that I would take a position on something was just absolutely laughable. You wouldn't. And I, you know, might have had very strong feelings about something, but I wouldn't do it. But this generation, or the two generations behind us, they see commentary as journalism. That line is not even blurred anymore. There is no line.
Yes.
And it's really right. Scary that.
And there's another syndrome that's just occurred to me. And that's what you might call what Roger Scruton. He wasn't the first to come up with this idea, because it's to do with neuro-linguistic programming, the concept of the spell word. And that's kind of words like homophobe or racist or all this sort of stuff. But another one is conspiracy theorist, you know. That's a spell word. Because it's kind of, the way I would depict it, it's like a kind of a cattle prod, you know, that electronic cattle prod. You want to get the cattle and you herd them in with the help of the prod, you know. And that's the way journalism now works in a lot of instances in relation to the LGBT agenda and all that kind of stuff. And you see, then you think this, in this, the COVID situation, the concept of conspiracy theorists is actually a cattle prod. So that it's easy to herd journalists with that, because as soon as you say, oh, are you a bit of a conspiracy theorist there? Suddenly they're going, oh, no, I take this very seriously. You know, I'm just asking questions, but I take it very seriously. And most of the time, they take it so seriously that they're prepared to lie for the government. And that's what's happened, you see. That's under the power of that spell phrase, conspiracy theorist.
Are we giving them too much of a hard time now in terms of, let me do my job for once today? I've not been doing my job that much today. No, in terms of, these are obviously very different times to, you know, I mean, when you were writing, and it wasn't that long ago, and Myers, who comes on this programme, and others, you know, there was that understanding that you could take a subject and take it apart, and you could say what needed to be said, and you'd have the backing. Isn't there an argument to be made now that the writers for the feature writers and the opinion writers for the broadsheets today in England and in Ireland, they're nervous and they're looking over their shoulders, and they shouldn't be. Maybe that's the reason. Yeah,
definitely. And the news reporters as well. You know, I mean, they're just kind of they're enthusiasts and advocates for government now, as opposed to being skeptics of government and critics of government. And I mean, that's a cultural thing. There are several reasons for that. One of them is that the training they get in journalism colleges, which seems to, in Ireland anyway, I mean, virtually, I looked at that a few years ago, and I saw that about 90% of the people teaching journalism in Irish journalism courses are essentially extreme Marxists. And they're inculcating that into the students, and they're telling them that their job is to promote a certain agenda. That's, you're going back to that idea of the position, you know, taking the position in the interview, you know. That was never, like, the position you would take would be, strategic. It would be kind of rhetorical in a certain sense, that you would position yourself to test the argument being put to you and to put up a resolute defense, in almost like a lawyer in a court. And that's kind of what journalism ought to do. But what you actually have now is advocates in a different sense, where they're actually passionate believers in the argument that they're putting, and they're dismissive of anything else. They're not there. So if you're going on now to talk about, you mentioned earlier on the importance of vitamins in relation to combating COVID-19. Yeah. If
saw on most mainstream radio or television programs, you'd be absolutely savaged by the journalists for even daring. You'd be called a conspiracy theorist and all this. And indeed, YouTube is banning videos. They're taking down videos.
Yeah.
For example, the wonderful Dr. Vernon Coleman on YouTube there. And he's had about a dozen videos.
Yeah,
he's a brilliant doctor. He's written over 100 books, like. He had a book out in April already about the COVID-19 hoax.
Brilliant, brilliant man. And yet, he, you know, so this is what journalism and this is what YouTube is doing. We're living in a terrible time. You see, this is the thing I said to you, I think, before, Rishi, about time going backwards. That, you know, it's almost as if, like, that you know, we are now, from, say, the 1980s, which is, in my view, I regard it as the heyday of my life. In cultural and journalistic terms, it was the most exciting time to be a journalist because we really were. You were never sure what you were, left or right or whatever. You didn't even think about it. I didn't think about it much in those terms. But you were always taking on the government, which made you look like a left winger, right?
Yeah, or feel like a left.
You were always against the establishment, against power. But now, you know, it's not like that anymore. Everybody, journalism now is like, it's like as if the end of history has actually come and we've moved past it. And they've decided, well, there's no point in taking on the government because the government is us, and the government is there's only one way of thinking about anything now, and that's the right way, and that there's no possibility of options or alternatives. And so we have to support this. But there's also, of course, the operations of power, the corporatocracy in Ireland, for example, which dictates, you know, and they can now, they can affect culture in a very immediate way through YouTube and Google and all these things. And so, you know, somebody who stands outside that can easily be demonized and made to look like an idiot. I mean, we found this, we took our action to the court, myself and Jim O'Doherty, there in April. I mean, none of the media reported anything that was in our papers. Even the papers were completely public, right? And they could have been accessed by the journalists. And you could have given the full page, if you wanted, to the content of our statement of grounds or our affidavit, which subsequently we filed, right? Now, that was never reported. What was reported in the end was only what the judge said. And the judge said what he said, knowing that that the truth would not be reported.
Yeah.
And he was perfectly safe in then tearing strips off us for a few little minor things that happened in the court, which had nothing to do with our submissions, more just off-the-cuff remarks. And he turned these into massive headlines, and the media jumped on them. With the result now that people don't actually know what went down. They don't even know that we were actually only at a preliminary stage, at a leave hearing. Most people think that, I meet them and they think, well, they say you lost your case. I think we didn't even have a case. We didn't take the case. We didn't get to the first fence because we didn't get to the judicial review stage at all. They didn't know that. Because the media refused to tell them what was actually going on.
Same happened here with Simon Dolan's action against the UK government. The media just ignored it.
Yes.
Ignored.
That's right. That's right. And, yeah. And a further point about that, Richie, the same thing happened in our case, which was the circular reasoning of the judge, which was essentially something like this. Well, the government faced a grave crisis and they had to do something, and therefore whatever they did was justified. That's kind of the logic of the judgment. Now, the whole point of the judgment, Judge, or the whole point of the hearing, Judge, was for you to judge whether, in fact, the government had any basis for acting at all, given that they never acted before in relation to any flu of any kind or any head cold of any kind that had happened in multiple years down through history. Nobody ever thought about locking down Great Britain for several weeks or months in response to such an event.
Locking up healthy people to prevent or to protect allegedly vulnerable people. When historically, what we always did was we, and I know this to be true because I've been making radio programs for years and years and years. Historically, when they got wind of a particularly virile strain of flu, they said to people that were potentially, you know, susceptible to it, they said, look, you got to look after yourselves now. You got to take the vitamin D. You got to be a bit careful about your whereabouts and where you're going and whatever. They certainly didn't say to 99% of the rest of the population, you've got to suspend your lives. You've got to put your welfare in jeopardy and lock yourselves into your houses because, you know, there are some people in society. But John, this is, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left on this. Thanks for persevering today. I what I want to do is when you get back home, I want to get you back on as soon as possible because we'll have a much better line. and we can cover more of this again in even greater depth. But I think now, with this mandated vaccine thing, we want you to have a vaccine, they're creating a new paradigm where they want us to think of ourselves as basically walking germ bags that are a constant danger to our neighbours. And by not having the vaccine, or not having the vaccine is akin to driving dangerously, or driving with three wheels on the car, or driving with a car with a bent chassis. They want us to see ourselves like that. So you might be fine, but you represent a clear and present danger to everybody else, and it's the right thing to do to have the vaccine. And if you want to just finish just talking about that as a concept, because it's ludicrous, but I think its time has come. Because if social media... Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, Richie. You know, that, you know, up to now, your health was... You know, first of all, if you were ill, you were an object of sympathy and compassion from other people. If you were, say, if you happened to be in work and you had to go in and you had the flu, you'd get, people would be giving you hot drinks and everything, like, and paracetamol and whatnot. You know, they'd take a break now and have her lie down there, whatever.
Yeah.
Now, that was like part of a culture in which your health was regarded as something to be protected and defended by each person and themselves, and that the state had a responsibility to come in if you couldn't look after your own health adequately yourself, in the sense that you got, that's where the NHS comes from, that concept comes from. They flipped that now, and what it is now is your health is a responsibility of yours in relation to the damage you may cause to others.
As you say, exactly that, that you're like a drunk driver now if you're sneezing in public.
Yeah.
And this is an amazing inversion, really, when you think about it, because as you say, again, it turns us into these, like we are, each of us, a walking biohazard. You know, a threat to all our neighbours, and our neighbours are a threat to us. And that is going to change, inevitably, that's going to change the very perception of the human person. Like, okay, I'll just give you an example, Richie. That we see, it is the extraordinary thing about our apprehension of one another, is we don't actually see everything that's there. And when we look at a person, we're clothed. So we don't see the naked person, for example. We don't see the person in certain situations. I won't go into them, but you know the kind of thing that I'm talking about. We see the person we see every day. We see a smiling person, a person with an easy word and a joke. We don't, like, you know, when we think of Elvis Presley, you know, this is sad for me to say these things, but just to give it a very graphic example, when we think of Elvis Presley, we don't see the moment of his death on the toilet bowl. We see the dancing, the spastic dance of Elvis.
Yeah, you know,
that glorious voice, that glorious persona that enchanted the world for so long and still does.
And that's the point. But you can actually flip it, and you can actually make people see Elvis. If you keep talking about it enough, and that's why I'm hesitant, you can do the other. So this is what they're doing. You can make action. You can change the perception of people of what they are. Because remember this, Richie, and again, this is falling into my own trap, but I just need to illustrate it, that there are more bacteria on the human body than there are actual human cells. That is a factual, an actual scientific fact. And there are far more viruses than there are bacteria. Now, so if you want to, you can see the human person in that way. And if you obscure the person's face, which is the mirror of the soul, you take away the spirit of the person, the individuality of the person, the character of the person, and you're looking simply at this, as you say, a germ bag. That's what they want. That's how sinister this is, in my opinion. And we therefore need to actually look at these people, you know, as worse than germ bags, and start to think of them the darkest people we've ever encountered. Because if they succeed in doing that to us, that our neighbours, our friends, our wives, our husbands, our beautiful children, our grandchildren, are to be seen in this way, that would be the greatest crime in the history of the human race, for sure. And we cannot be allowed. I don't care what the reason is. We cannot allow that to happen. We have to wake up from this sleep we're in now, collectively, this entrancement that we have suffered as a result of these evil people. We need to shake it off, to shake ourselves, and to begin to look again at the world and see it as a place where there is yet risk. Yes, this is risk, as Jonathan Sumption has so wonderfully said. You know, life is risk. The things that are worthwhile about life involve risk, you know, and of some kind. And that's what has made it. And you see, this is a symptom, and this is a complicated argument to be bringing in the last couple of minutes, like, but this is a symptom of a post-religious society. Because in the past, Richie, you know, when terrible things happen, when somebody died or tragically or whatever, people will say, it's the will of God. And that seems to, I thought that's the thing you could dismiss in a certain way. But you think about it, like, it's a way of actually accommodating that what has happened and allowing us to move past it without recrimination, without creating, you know, all kinds of measures in order to prevent it happening again. Futilely, of course. You cannot stop the attrition of life. You cannot stop the attrition of death. The idea that politicians can intrude to stop a virus, a tiny virus, in circulation among the human quotient of the planet, is absolute gibberish. It cannot be done. The whole point of, they talk about the second wave. What is the second wave, Richie, now, except the first wave that wasn't allowed to happen? Yeah. That's what it is. And you see, the whole point about it is, if you were to succeed in actually preventing viruses, this is the paradox of the human biological condition. If you were actually to succeed in preventing a particular virus from getting to and infecting huge numbers of human beings, and it was to do it again and again and again, what would be the cumulative end result of that? Well, essentially, you would so weaken the human race that they would die.
Of course you would. Of course you would. Yeah.
That the very thing that they're trying to protect us from is the thing that protects us all along for that, from that, up to the final end, the final moment when that little virus is the final straw that finishes off a person who is already dying of various ailments, unfortunately, tragically, in their 80s or 90s.
Very sadly.
That's precisely what's happened here. And in sense, what they are trying to do, therefore, Richie, is to become God and say to nature, go back, nature, go back. That's what Boris Johnson is doing. Go back, nature. Well, what hell? Has he a chance in hell of doing that?
John, do me a favour. When you're back home, get in touch with me as soon as you have an evening free, even if that's in a week or two. I know you're travelling.
I will, Richie.
Because
I'll be back in Dublin this weekend. Next week, maybe. Yeah.
Do, because we could hear you. And thanks for persevering with it, but we've not had the best of line all evening. But you're an eloquent speaker, so we were able to hear everything you were saying. So I really appreciate that. But it'd be nice not at all, mate. It'd be nice to get you back on again real soon, and thanks for your time today and continued success on your travels around the west of the country. Thanks, John.
A pleasure. Thank you, Richie. God bless.
And bye for now, and God bless you too. John Waters, the acclaimed Irish journalist in water. Jesus Christ, it's a Monday. Acclaimed Irish journalist and author. It's not that difficult to say, Richie. Yes. Apologies for the line there. We couldn't do anything about that. Either of us. He's in Sligo. He said that there were intermittent problems over the weekend, but because the weather is fair there today, he was pretty certain that we'd be okay, but there are issues with the line. Apologies. I know there are a lot of people excited about this conversation today. We'll do it again. We'll just put it down to Monday. Again, academic publications, studies have been done that prove it. Things go wrong on Mondays. They always do. They always have. And maybe they always will. A couple of things came in there while I was talking. One or two of you a bit unhappy about some of the things I was saying earlier on in the programme about the journalist Emma Barnett or Barnett, and a listener whom I've not heard from before, called Angela. I said that there was a whiff of misogyny about my commentary on Emma Barnett's performance. Maybe there was, and if there was, well, I don't know. If it came across like that, it's certainly not the way I am or who I am. It's the piece. What I was doing was basically highlighting what has become of the BBC. And with respect to Emma Barnett, that's a presenter. She's a presenter who has come across our radar more than once in the last few years. And my bringing up or digging up of her own personal past and her father's criminality is not childishness insofar as it's not me having a dig because it's an easy, you know, it's a cheap and easy thing to do. It's something I've done in the past, and I did it today again to highlight the absurdity of somebody like that working for the BBC, doing that and doing it with impunity and immunity. Staggering to me. And, you know, not to say that I agree with any of the things that Wiley had to say in his Twitter tirade on Friday. I don't agree with a lot of what he had to say, of course not. And specifically the banking thing, I'll say what I've always said. The great banking dynasties of the world are and have been families who purport to be Jewish. But they haven't benefited Jewish people. Jewish people, and by Jewish people we mean people who identify as being Jewish, culturally Jewish people, have not in any way benefited from that or are not any less under the jackboot of the tyranny that we are watching unfold in front of our eyes every day of the week. It's ridiculous to think that Jewish people are sitting around controlling the world and controlling events. It's not the case. And I've said this a million times going back to when I first began making programmes like this, and not because I was censoring myself or because I fear to say how I really feel. This is how I really feel. Zionism and the State of Israel is a different thing entirely. You know, you can't go much further than I've gone when it comes to talking about the State of Israel and how it came to be and Zionism as an ideology. You know, the State of Israel has no right to exist. It shouldn't exist. It is a pariah state. It is an apartheid state. It's an abomination. It is a boil on the arse of the Middle East. It shouldn't be there. The IDF are Nazis in every sense of the word. And I don't care how many Jewish people are offended by that. I never have done and I never will do. That's my position. And if you don't like my position on that, you are welcome to come and debate me on it. Not to invite me to a debate at Media City in Salford with BBC cameras to try and, you know, set me up to entrap me and to film me for an hour and a half and then put 2 minutes of it online. No, no, no. If you want to debate that, we'll debate it all day long. Jews died in miserable situations and conditions in concentration camps across Germany and Poland. I visited some of them. But that doesn't mean that I can't say that the government of Israel or its thugs in the IDF don't behave like Nazis. They do. And I don't give a shit what the international definition of anti-Semitism is. I couldn't care less. That's a gaslighting thing to convince people like me that we don't mean what we really say. But I do mean what I really say about everything. I don't hide behind words and I don't hide behind, you know, clever phraseology. You know, and smoke and mirrors and all that. No, I mean what I say about anything. Ask me for an opinion on anything, I'll give you one, unless I know nothing about it. In which case, I'll say I know nothing about that. Nothing. But about the State of Israel, I know a lot. So I despise it. I despise it. And there are people in this country who don't like somebody of my experience saying that the State of Israel has no right to exist. The Jewish diaspora is a myth. Israel's existence, quoting the former Prime Minister Golda Meir, stands as the result of a promise made by God himself. It's a nonsense. 800,000 Palestinians were murdered, slaughtered, tortured and kicked out of Palestine by thuggish terrorist groups like the Stern Gang and others. I hate Israel's existence. But Israel is not the only evil in the world. Israel is not responsible for everything that we see today. Israel is not behind the lockdown. Israel is not behind the possibility of 200,000 deaths, suicides, broken hearts, poverty, the inevitable mess, you know, we're going to see in the coming years because of the lockdown. No, it's intellectually redundant to suggest that. But it's not intellectually redundant to talk about the presence of Jewish men and women in the media in the UK. That's not intellectually redundant to talk about that. It's not bigotry to talk about that. It isn't racism to talk about that. And I won't be gaslit by anybody. I've got balls of steel, luckily enough. I don't care what is said about me. But the fact that Newsnight has got three female presenters, two of them are Jewish. The fact that the BBC's political editor, Laura Kunzberg, is Jewish. The fact that Robert Peston, ITV's political editor, is Jewish. These aren't coincidences. These are things that we should talk about. So what's going on there then, Richie? Well, I'm prepared because of my experience over the years, because of the fact that I've learned over the years that certain things that I held to be absolutely true, over the years I've realised were not as true or not as black and white as I thought they were. I'm prepared to be open-minded about it. So the fact that there are lots of Jews in the UK news media, maybe at one time I would have thought that there was a conspiracy there. What I think now is, I think there are shades of grey. Laura Kunzberg, Peston, Nick Robinson, Emily Maitlis, of course, at Newsnight, the other one whom I forgot, the other woman, the other Jewish woman, and of course Emma Barnett on Radio 5 Live. Their presence in UK media doesn't benefit Jewish people. I know a lot of Jewish people, and they are no better off or no worse off than we are. They are no more enlightened or no less enlightened than we are. They go about their lives, scraping together the rent, their children's expenses, mortgages, whatever, and they breathe a sigh of relief and they start again the following month. It doesn't benefit Jewish people. My great friend and colleague Hayden Hewitt said to me when I put to him the extraordinary presence of Jewish men and women in UK news media, Hayden said, well, consider nepotism as a possibility. I said, all right, fair enough. I don't see it that way, but yet, fair enough, it's an argument. I can have it. I pressed on that. I would say that the presence of a lot of Jewish people at the top of media in the UK and in America is more about protecting the state of Israel from any scrutiny whatsoever. And that's got nothing to do with Jewish people, most of whom are not supporters of the state of Israel. At least, let me qualify that. The ones I know are not any great supporters of the state of Israel. Don't pay much attention to it. So the Wiley rant and the conduct of the Jewish, whenever she feels like it, Jewish presenter, Emma Barnett on Radio 5 Live this morning, deserved calling out today. You might think there was the whiff of misogyny about it, maybe because Kay gets a bit of stick. Sophie Ridge gets a bit of stick. But that's the way it is now. Many of the leading political interviewer roles these days are held by women. I mentioned Kunzberg, Emily Maitlis, Kay Burley, Breakfast on Sky. So the ones you find yourself criticising happen to be women, but there isn't any misogyny. At least I don't think so. But Barnett is fair game. When you go on a diatribe, as she went on about Wiley, said that, you know, you wouldn't accept an apology from him, as if he had anything to apologise to you for. You're a non-observant Jew, which means you're not Jewish. You're an English girl who went to a very expensive private school in Manchester, paid for by the fact that your father trafficked in young girls and prostitutes. And of course, you didn't do that, so you shouldn't have to carry that millstone around your neck all your life, but it does beg the question, how the fuck did you get the job, you know? Imagine getting a job at the BBC, one of the big jobs, if you had that sort of family background. So it's not black and white. And you can't, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't in terms of presenting programmes like this with my audience. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. If I don't say that the Jews are an evil little clique that are controlling world events, well then I'm a shill or I'm a coward. The fact is, the Jews are not an evil little clique controlling world events. They're not. It's a nonsense. If you don't say that the Holocaust was a hoax, you're a shill or you're a coward. But the Holocaust wasn't a hoax. Jews were rounded up, interned in camps, tortured and murdered. State of Israel is a totally different thing. For me, I've always made the differentiation. Anyway, let's have a tune. So Angela, thanks for your email and your rant about misogyny and me having a go at Jewish people. Manny Friedman wrote an amazing article for the Times of Israel a few years ago. And the Times of Israel, having published it, deleted it. And it was about Jewish influence in Hollywood, in US media, and basically in Western media, full stop. It was very honest. It was funny in places, but also alarming, right? They deleted the article, and we only have the article because people were able to download it and copy and paste it. But it's got nothing to do with Jewish people. That's why it's not black and white. You've got to think outside the box. Friedman said the Hollywood studios are basically controlled by Jewish people. Yes, they are. There's no doubt about that. But why? And who does it benefit? Does it benefit Jewish people? No, it doesn't. The ones in Hollywood getting the 7 or 8 figure salary, annual salaries, yes, it benefits them, but does it benefit Jewish people? No. Who does it benefit? It benefits Israel. That's a different argument entirely. It's a different discussion entirely. And that's where I've come from my entire life. This has been building up for a while because I get a lot of stick about this, you know, about the Jews. And you won't call out the Jews, Richie. Why would I call out the Jews? It's a cultural group of people who believe in a fairy godfather in the sky. Doesn't make them any different from the people I grew up with who believe in a different type of fairy godfather in the sky. But anyway, here's Morrissey and the last of the famous international playboys. And this is the Richie Allen Radio Show for Monday, July the 27th. Morrissey and the last of the international, famous international playboys. That's the one, that's the one. Yeah. We're coming, we're getting close to the end. Couple of things. The campaign against anti-Semitism, which I've had a few run-ins with and invited to debate several times, are a laughable group of moronic attack dogs that, whether they realise it or not, they're basically a UK wing or the British wing of the Hasbara project. Now, they might not officially be, and they might say that they're not, but they exist only to create hysteria around Jewish identity, around Jewish communities in the UK, to create this sense of doom and this sense of fear that Jews are under increasing attack and that things are getting worse for Jewish people in the UK. It's this particular group that has gone after this grime artist, Wiley, who said some silly things in these tweets on Friday. And the campaign against anti-Semitism exists really to push a false narrative, which I just described, that things are terrible, that anti-Semitism is everywhere, and wherever you go, you'll find people that represent a danger to Jews. Now, this is bullshit. Anti-Semitism is non-existent in the United Kingdom. And what Wiley did on Friday is not anti-Semitism. It's not hatred of Jewish people. And never forget that the largest ever study in this country of attitudes towards Jewish people was, if I remember correctly, conducted by the Institute for Jewish Policy Research. I think I'm right because I've made this point 1,000 times. Around about 3 or 4 years ago, I think 3 years ago, they conducted the biggest survey ever conducted in Great Britain and found that anti-Semitism is basically non-existent. That attitudes towards Jews in the UK are amongst the most favourable on the planet. Of course, people don't care. But it's not about Jews, this. Because Jews are one part of it. You have other alleged vulnerable groups as well, whether it be people who identify as the opposite sex to the one they were born, whether it's other ethnic minority groups. What this is about, it's a long-standing agenda that's in full swing now to gaslight the entire population and to make us feel worthless, to make us feel dirty, to make us feel subhuman by convincing us that we are, despite all evidence to the contrary, that we are very bad, hostile, bigoted, nasty, spiritless, I don't know, dreadful human beings, basically. The agenda is to break us down mentally by convincing us that we are worthless, that we are vile, that we are full of hate, even though we know that the opposite is true. We know it's complete nonsense. But why do they do that? Well, they do that in the Marine Corps. They do that in the Royal Marines in the UK. They take people in and they break them down into nothing by humiliating them and convincing them that black is white and white is black. Why? Because that mind then, once broken, becomes very malleable. You can work with it. And we're being told all the time that we're anti-Semitic and that we're anti-trans and anti-gays and lesbians. And we know we're not. We know this. Every one of us knows we're not. Nothing is black and white. You know, I might get an eye sometimes every time I turn on the telly and there's a gay guy on there. But it's not because I've got anything wrong, anything against homosexuality. I'm like, not another one. Right. It's the same when I see another Jewish presenter. Not another one. There must be other presenters of the news, right? But of course, I don't have anything against Jews or gays. We know this implicitly. But they're breaking us down to convince us that we are what we are not. That we're awful. But we know we're not. We know we're very complex beings. We know that we change our minds as often as we change our fucking underwear about issues. We know that we make emotional judgments about things far too often without considering context or all the facts to hand. Of course we do. We're human. It's what makes us human. It's one of the great experiences of being human. Overreacting. Right? I bet you Wiley was overreacting. It's a stupid thing to be saying the Jews own the police and the Jews are doing this. Of course it's fucking stupid. Doesn't make him evil though. Doesn't mean his career should be over. And it doesn't mean he hates Jews. Probably means a Jewish person has fucked him over. Or at least he thinks they have. Whether they have or not is another thing. But keep that in mind. This gaslighting agenda, we're not talking enough about it. This barrage of shit from the media telling you all the time what you are. Don't let them tell you what you are. You know you don't hate Jews. You know you don't hate blacks. You know you don't hate Muslims. You know damn well you don't hate women. You don't hate disabled people. You don't hate trans people. You don't hate anybody. There are aspects of people's cultural identities which piss you off, fair enough, but you don't hate them. Don't let them fucking tell you you do. I won't allow them to do it. They tried to do it to me last year. And I beat them. Nobody's going to tell me that I hate anybody because I ask questions or because I despise the state of Israel and I'd rather it didn't exist. I'd rather it was Palestine with Jews living there side by side with the rightful occupiers of the land. That's my opinion. Doesn't mean I hate anybody. We need to stand up to it. Not allow anybody beat you down. You know, I said it before, it always reminds me of that bastard who beats and kicks the shit out of his wife. Constantly tells her how fucking useless she is. And it's your fault. That's what's happening to the global population. And it's driving wedges between people. You're useless. you're racist, you're dirty, you're too fat, you don't care about people, you're a germ bag, spreading your diseases. How about fuck off? How about them apples? Eh? How about I'm not? How about I'm a decent human being? Flawed for sure, but I'm all right. I don't hate anybody. And don't hide on your fucking social media. If you want to challenge me about it, I'll give you a platform. But you won't. Because your argument has no merit. I'll speak to you again tomorrow at 5 o'clock Tuesday for Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. Until then, bye now. Thanks, John. You and me.